Blog Talk Radio.
Well, I've had one too many cigarettes burning up my lungs. Had the taste of one too many lips hanging off my tongue. Oh, oh, oh. Sunday morning getting high, drinking here alone. Thinking up a brand new alibi for not coming home. Oh, oh.
Allows us to explore our dark sides and find our way to the light. I celebrate people who, like the founder of the show, recognize that they are on a dangerous path and make the difficult adjustment to be an amazing person. Share poems that reveal the duality of our vulnerability and strength. Capture the internal battle of the demon and angel on your shoulders. Deep poetry, thoughtful commentary, and fun chatter for sinners, saints, and everyone in between. This is Part Sinner, Part Saint on Late Night Poets After Midnight. We are a group on allpoetry.com. You don't have to be in the group to participate, but it's more fun if you are because you can chat with us and read along. And, right, I hear the laughter there. You know, it's a trap. Come to our little playground. How are you tonight, sir?
Good, good. I could not help but chuckle at the tone of your voice. It was very nice. I liked it.
I'm just luring people to the party.
Exactly, like a siren, only to crash on the rocks of pain and hope. Right?
I mean, I do admit the sinner part of the show, right?
Well, you have to admit the sinner part. Oh, that's the fun part, right?
Yes. Exactly.
Well, I'm glad I was able to spend some. I am glad to be able to spend some time with you tonight. It was, yeah, it's a little different from me. Not having been shared with you before, it's a pleasure.
For me as well. I'm really happy that you're able to be here. Babbler is unfortunately very unwell, so she's been away for a while, and she will be for at least a few more weeks. So I really appreciate having help, and I'm wishing her well in her recovery.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And Phil was so kind as to let me switch my nights during the summer. It's really hard for me to do Friday nights, so... for the summer, we're doing what is for me Wednesday night, but technically for late night poets is considered to be Thursday morning because time difference. So it's only 9:30 here for me, but I know it's after midnight according to our state.
Oh, that's why you're so chipper all the time at 3 hours
earlier.
In the morning.
it
comes clear now.
Yes. I'm cheating in that way, where the after midnight show is not, in fact, after midnight for me. When I first joined LNP, it was Rima who had convinced me to, I thought we were on something for his time zone, which it turned out wasn't true either. I just figured because he was the host, it took me a while to catch on. But no, different times. That's okay. Our theme tonight is Invisible Chains, which was inspired by a song written by Lauren Jarugi. And it's called Invisible Chains. I'm kind of a comic book geek, and Harley Quinn is one of my favorites. She's very overlooked because she seems like she's just kind of like ditzy sidekick, but actually she's a psychologist, and there's more to her than it seems. So I was listening to the soundtrack of the movie Birds of Prey, and some of the lyrics struck me in this song. So actually, I'm going to play the prompt song, and then we'll get into the poetry that people wrote inspired by it. So here is Invisible Chains.
I've been trapped in a cage. Sorrow said I should stay, but I found beauty. Working on my soul. This ain't over yet.
Peripheral was really well done. You know, it's simple the way it's written, the future blurred to the left, the future blurred to the right, just a fading past, but it's really striking. Where is it now? There was a spot I wanted to talk about. Dreaming of the dining car, because the dining car is kind of like living in the moment, whereas in that last car, you're staring at the past. If you're the engineer at the front, you're focused on the future, just trying to get there. But the people who are in the dining car, they're enjoying themselves. They are on their vacation. They are having their conversations. They're in the moment. They're not looking back. They're not trying to look forward. They're just enjoying their moment. And he's dreaming of being the people in the dining car and being able to not stare at the past and to not panic about the future. But that's not where he is. He doesn't get to be in the moment. He's still being pulled along at the end of the car. And then one day the train will stop, and unfortunately that stop is death. At least that's how I see it. So this is actually quite a dark piece, but very well done. What did you think?
That was a great comment, Luciana. I like this a great deal as well, but I start with questions, not answers. The title, The Doppler Effect. Now, that's both an audible and a visual effect, I believe. I mean, if you ever heard a train from a distance, the pitch of its humming keeps rising until it's right there on you, and then it fades and goes down as it passes you. And then it's a wonderful sound to hear, and it's called the Doppler effect, I believe. And to some extent, I think the red shift and blue shift in light, depending on whether it's receding or approaching, is also kind of a Doppler effect. So I was looking for where that fits into the poem. Excuse me. And I believe the second stanza handles that. I'm on the last car outside. Facing, excuse me. I'm on the last car outside, facing back. All I see is the fading past, the future blurred to the left, the future blurred to the right. Just a fading past. The past is fading and the future is blurred. And I thought that had something to do with it being called the Doppler effect. People who are on a train don't notice the Doppler effect, however. So it was just interesting all the way around. And yeah, the train is life. And that train does not stop until it does. At the end, as you observe. Now, I've thought the poem had strengths, and it certainly hews to the prompt, and I did think it was a good write.
That was an excellent comment. I didn't really get into the title, but that is, there's always meaning in Daniel's titles. I know that, and I'm glad that you pointed that out.
Yep. So, where do we go next?
Now I have one by Jenny the Deep that I will read. This is called Indefinitely Imprisoned Until Death by Jenny the Deep. Trapped in this cage of guilt, secretly, sorrow tells me I am to stay. My back bends, my neck tilts, watching your conscious sway. Never thought I would desert you. Always thought, keep your naughty secrets. Triggered when you put me danger too. My flightless wings shed painfully in regrets. Broken glass hearts shattered, shards spreading systematically. Locked forever in this cage, battered. Taking over me is sorrowful insanity. Unable to locate the key, I am forever cursed with silence. Never meant to break free, anticipating my end. Foreseen to be violent. End poem.
That was an excellent read. You always put a lot of emotion into your into your speech and your reading, which I enjoy, indefinitely imprisoned until death. That has a ring of finality about it. Trapped in this cage of guilt, secretly sorrow tells me I am. When you are so guilty as to feel trapped with no way out, how do you escape that feeling? Especially since if you feel guilty, it's almost like a self-inflicted punishment. And sorrow is the key that turns the lock. She left him. She was triggered. Her heart is broken, and she locks herself in the cage. She calls herself battered. Taking over me is sorrowful insanity. When you are so filled with grief, so filled with emotion, they can feel like insanity. As you turn left, you turn right, nothing is clear, nothing seems to make sense. An idea that was positive a moment ago, now all wrong the next moment. And you can't find that key to get out. You feel cursed, perhaps never meant to break free. Anticipating my end was seen to be violent. Is she talking about suicide? Talking about something different? It's a powerful piece, and it really poses a certain vulnerability, which always makes a piece attractive. And what did you think of it, Faziana?
Well, I like what you had to say, and I also thought maybe she was talking about suicide there in the last line. For seen to be violent. If she's in the cage herself, probably would be her who's doing it, but being battered, you also don't know what way she's been battered, so who put her in the cage. Now, I'm pretty sure it's metaphorically battered, but, you know, in the story context of things, we don't know. And when my favorite part was watching your conscious sway. And for some reason, that made me think about on the really old school clocks, there's that thing that, like, hangs down from the clock and it goes sways back and forth. I can't even remember what that's called. My grandfather had one, and it was, like, there's two kind of, like, sticks that hang down below the actual clock face, and they sway back and forth like a pendulum kind of thing. And I found it very hypnotizing to watch that on the clock. And for some reason, when it says your conscious is swaying, I'm thinking about, like, the person who's feeling guilty, and they're like, am I going to do the right thing? Am I going to keep with my bad path? Like, kind of like going back and forth and being lost in time with that. And then because it's talking about the cage, I also kind of picture the cage rocking as the person tries to deal with their situation. Now, this is not her conscience. She's watching someone else's. I thought it said conscience. It doesn't. Now that I'm looking at it, it's conscious. Your conscious way. All right.
You know, you're saying something very interesting there, Faziana. Have you ever watched someone who's on the verge of action, but they don't want to engage yet? They'll kind of stand there and they'll sway a little left, they'll sway a little right. You know what I mean? As
yes.
If prepared for action.
Yes, exactly. So she's watching someone like that while she is feeling trapped. She doesn't have the options the way someone else does. She has flightless wings, and she's being forced to desert whoever this is because they're choosing the wrong way. They're swaying to the direction she can't be a part of. She's been writing about that subject quite a bit lately in different ways, but I feel like this is a series for her of being connected to someone who's made a bad choice, and she's brought it to life in a whole different way here than her other poems. So, Jenny, you're really getting a whole bunch of different ways of telling your story, and I think that's impressive that you can change it to fit the prompt. Alrighty, so now we have an audio by G.A. Grimm, which I'm excited about. I haven't listened to it yet, but G.A. Grimm always gives us some wonderful audios. So here it is, Nutshell by G.A. Grimm.
Nutshell by G.A. Grimm. Life is moving and grooving, work to improving. I'm trying, I'm crying. One day even die. Just going, just flowing. Never ever knowing. Always wanting, it's haunting. Life just keeps taunting. Keep taking, taking. Everything is breaking. Still saying, still praying. Just hoping we're staying. But keep shirking and smirking. This is not working. Destiny is calling and drawling. And I just keep falling.
End poem. Thank you so much for giving us the audio, George. I really like that G.A. Grimm always gives us an audio so we can hear it in his own voice, even if he can't call. There's also an interesting way that he has used spacing within his poem. So when he says falling, he writes it just one letter per line. So it actually looks like the word is falling. Plus, most of it is in like a stanza, but there's a big space before, and I just keep, and then it does the falling, like he has been falling visually within the poem, which just adds an extra element to it. And he has a lot of rhyming going on in this poem. I like life just keeps taunting, and that seems like a real problem. But taunting is not usually a verb that you would associate with something as abstract as life. But it makes perfect sense. And I also like the use of shirking, which is not as common. As some of the verbs, and then enthralling, it kind of goes into a more positive twist there right at the end, but then he's still falling. So it's a brevity, and I feel like it gets your feelings going. What did you think?
I like it quite a bit. It's a novel form. And the ending is very effective visually, because from a distance, it kind of looks like a shoreline and then, bam, waterfall. I enjoyed the rhyming in this. There's a lot of motion. Life is moving and grooving, just flowing. The haunting and the taunting, I have to like quite a bit, because life will tease you. And I can feel like you're being haunted by bad luck. Every time you think you've got it by the short hair, it shows you that you don't have any grasp of it at all. What do? We keep taking, because what else can we do from life to take if we can't contribute? And aching, everything is breaking, regardless of what we try. Things seem to break, but you still have to try. You have to pray. You have to hope. And we do shirk, the shortcut. There are times when we should get deeply engaged, deeply involved in something, and we choose not to because, you know, emotionally it's heavy. It feels like work. Even though he says this is not working, what he tries to do is not working in terms of gaining any kind of control. And that control is yielded to destiny, and there's no control over destiny. And it's thrilling, just like a carnival ride that spins you around so fast. And all you can do is hang on, and you keep going. It's a very effective piece.
I really like the way that you frame that. And now I'm going to put you to work as a reader again.
All right. Is it up?
Yeah. It should be Inside These Walls by Poetically Written.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Inside These Walls. Guess I've built a living hell, though I've got my place to dwell. Lost, alone inside this shell. Each bar was forged to build a cell. Sorrow holds, never folds, and triggers minds to overload. Fills the air from which we breathe. Take and see our goals achieved. Life is hard, but don't you quit. Set the sails, rid the pit. The struggle's real, I will admit. World of light, but none of lit. You see, my house is not a home. I've walked and thought, but all alone. I'm here inside these walls of stone. Inside myself, I'm sitting prone. End poem.
Excellent read. This has some nice rhyme to it. And I like the idea that each bar was forged, as if, like, it's very intentional, and everything was made on its own. It's not like it was like, here's a cage. It was like the cage was gradually put together. That cell was built by decisions that were made, by experiences that were had. I feel like those walls were built as an ongoing thing through life, until eventually the poet was trapped, or the character. Those sorrows that hold, not fold, so the sorrows become the bars. And feeling overloaded is definitely something that happens to the best of us. And I like that it talks about pulling the air away. Because it's amazing how much emotion can influence your body. Like, there's physical symptoms that come with emotion. When you are truly in the, like, depths of sorrow, it's hard to breathe. It's difficult to stand. It's like your whole body is hit. You know, when you have a heartbreaking moment, sometimes it feels like you've been shot in the chest. I like when people, when they're writing about emotion, include the kind of physical feelings that come along with that, because there's definitely like a mind-body connection something like the detail of about breathing can bring up that realistic feeling in our mind. Where is it now? I also really like the ending of I'm sitting prone. There's that vulnerability. Even within the mental walls that have been built, I mean, often when people build those walls in their mind, it's for protection. They close themselves in to keep the pain out. But then you're trapped inside, and becoming even more vulnerable within that mental cage is just a strong statement. I thought that was a good way to end it.
Great comment.
You read it for us. Oh, thank you. And what did you think?
Well, I don't disagree with anything that you said. That first line, yes, I've built a living hell. But he says, guess I've built. It's almost as if he stood back from, and then realized that it somehow inadvertently, hell, guess I built the living hell. Almost ruefully, the line is delivered. But, you know, it's all that I've got, and I've got to live in it. But I live in it alone. There is some hope in this. Life is hard, but don't you quit. Set the sails to rid the pit. The struggle's real, I will admit. A world of light, but none are lit. He realizes the struggle that he's set for himself. And, you know, when you're in a cage, maybe you think you don't have to struggle, but yeah, you want to get out of it, you're going to struggle a lot. And then that house is not a home. And then that kind of reminds me of a song. I don't know if you know it, but that the line in it just about like that. And when you build yourself this living hell, you build this cage bit by bit, and you find that you're all alone. Sitting prone is an interesting phrase. Normally you're going to sit upright, but sitting prone wasn't if you're waiting but lying on your back. All there is to do. It's well crafted, and it certainly communicates the prompts, and I did like it.
Well said. It looks like we have another caller. Just loading them in now.
No, I'm not talking.
Hello.
I'm cleaning.
Sorry, what was that? Who is this?
I said I'm just listening. I'm cleaning. You don't want to have me on the radio because you're getting hit.
Oh, okay. I'll mute you then so you can listen. Thank you.
All right.
Okay. They're just going to listen.
Cleaning and listening. I like that.
It's the way to do it, you know. Distract yourself from the cleaning.
Mm-hmm.
Our next poem, still to the prompt one, is Rattled Cage by Stephen T. Wellman. We burn bridges to protect us from one another. We burn bridges to disconnect us from a global galaxy of fallen stars. We fail to see their shine, the rhythm and rhyme. We create metaphorical monsters. We crawl inside veins, create illusionary chains, hold one another hostage. Our differences define us. Puppeteers rattle our cage and remind us they stir the pot, so you know not how much we are a lot alike. End poem.
Hey, I like the way you read that. Nice job. Rattled cage. You know, this is filled with interesting lines. We burn bridges to protect us from one another. In this day and age, I cannot disagree with that statement at all. Amazing how we can wound each other, harm each other. There's an anger, a societal anger, a societal distrust of the neighbor, of the person we see. And you will want to disconnect yourself from that kind of society or from that kind of feeling. So again, you burn the bridges and you disconnect from a global galaxy of fallen stars, all the good things in life, the wide world. We don't see those stars for their shine. We don't see the rhythm and the rhyme of life, the pulse beat. And we do create metaphorical monsters. We take things that shouldn't be monsters and we make them into metaphorical monsters. And we crawl inside veins maybe too deep. You don't want to open those veins because you will bleed yourself to death. And we create the chains that bind us. They are illusionary. And in that way, we can hold each other hostage. Our differences define us, but, you know, I've always also felt that our differences can be the truest indicator of where we are. Because if everybody can get together, regardless of the differences, then you know you've got something. The people who rattle our cage, I see as the outside influences of media, not all media, But most media loves to rattle the cage and remind us of the differences, some more than others. Some accept the melting pot, others don't. And with all that in mind, you don't know how similar we are. We are very similar. Yes, we have differences, but those differences define us, take us out from being a herd animal, making us an individual. Great little piece here. And it was well read by you, Efasiana. What did you think?
I enjoyed it. I'm a big fan of Stephen T. Wellman. I especially liked We Crawl Inside Veins, Create Illusionary Chains. The crawling inside veins kind of works in two ways. You can crawl inside your own veins and, like, you know, just kind of, like, trap yourself and think about where you are and have that kind of like internal battle. And you can crawl inside the veins of others. You can be under their skin, kind of like when, if you insult someone, if you, you know, destroy their confidence, you become that part of them that continues to run through them after the cut heals. If you're inside their veins, you're that little voice in the back of their mind telling them they're not good enough. Create illusionary chains. We feel trapped within our roles, within labels that are put on us, within the system that divides us. And I really do like how it talks about that we are a lot alike. It's just we've had this polarization where people try to take extremes and kind of divide whatever it's about. It becomes like this versus them, us versus them, this versus that. Everything's become very like divided. And I feel like that was always a thing, but somehow with the internet, it's there's that confirmation bias where if you look up what you're trying to look up, you'll find other people who said the stuff that you wanted to say. And because of the search terms and stuff you use, you end up finding people who are on your side, and it becomes like this big difference of where people are getting their information and where people are getting their opinions, and they're just even more of a divide than before, and people kind of pitted against each other on whatever subject. Really, there's a lot that people do have in common, and I feel like he's recognizing that you know, almost anyone, if you really get to know them, they're not going to be what you think based on whatever preconceptions you may have had based on differences. Where is it now? There's part. The metaphorical monsters. That made me think about this picture book that I really like called Bear and Bee. And in it, the bear's about to have some honey, and a bee comes along, and the bear says, "Did you see any bees? I don't want a bee to come find out that I'm taking the honey." And the bee's like, "Have you ever met a bee?" Because, like, very clearly it's a bee. And the bear's like, "No, but I've heard they're horrible." And he, like, goes on in, like, this big story about, like, how awful bees are. And it's like, they're so mean and they're scary and they're big and blah, blah. And at the end, the bee's like, "So I'm a bee. And we've kind of been friends all day. And do you want some of my honey?" And it was just like, you know, there's this preconception that people have about someone who's different, and sometimes they're not as scary as it seems. And it feels like Stephen's kind of going for that. I mean, I relate everything to picture books because I'm a children's librarian. So I'm not infantilizing your poem, Stephen. That's just how I think.
That's a great little story.
I love that picture book. I really do. it's so great because the bee's just like, "I am a bee," just casually.
Right. I mean, yeah, it makes its point exceedingly well.
Right? Yes.
Yeah, this is a shortish poem. It packs a punch. It's got layers.
It does. Stephen's really good at that. He gets those layers in even in the brevities. Our second prompt is, still taste in metal, it lingers on my lips. I let it haunt me so I don't ever forget. Now, the only response to this is a story that someone wrote. So it's one of our longer entries, but they did an audio. And it's a story poem, so I'm going to play that. Here we go. It's by the poet. And
here we go. The Magician's Jasper's Fate. My emperor, this is the friend of mine and my father's, Delmontine Rattle, the new ambassador. What, the Alpha Centauri system? Said Prince Jasper, the grandson of the Emperor of the Universe. Nice to meet you, said the Emperor of the Universe, Sephiroth Sergeant. Greetings and salutations, said the Blue Reptilian Ambassador. Nice earrings, remarked the grandson of the Emperor. Like the Emperor of the local Earth system. Of the collection of earrings, Rattle wore. They symbolize my rank, said Rattle. Ambassador, asked Forrest. No, Emperor of Alpha Centauri, said Rattle. Oh, nice. Why are you acting as your own ambassador? Surprised? My last ambassador shamed us. I could not trust anyone but me to get the mining deal with Beetlejuice. We need to get it done right, said Rattle. It is an important deal, Sephiroth said. Yes, said Rattle. Emperor Delmontine, this is Ambassador Alexite of Beetlejuice, said Blake. Cool, Ambassador Rattle. I am just here as an ambassador, Rattle said plainly. Okay, said Blake. Oh, your brother-in-law, Monsieur Gar, from the Exoration Embassy. Need to have a word with him. Come, Prince Jasper, said Rattle. Say, we'll bid each other goodbye. Jasper and Rattle wandered off to meet Monsieur Gar. Only one of them would be seen alive again. The other would be accused of the other one's murder. Why did you kill him? Demanded the man in charge of the galactic police of the survivor. I didn't kill him or anyone. I'm not a killer, let alone the necromancer, said the accused, who was thought to be an assassin called the Necromancer. You are. You did. We have got you at last. You psychopath. You won't kill again, said the Imperial General of the Guard. Uncle, this is crazy, said Jasper's father, Prince Lakelandite, who was the necromancer to Sephiroth's brother, Rogue Knight. We didn't know he was the necromancer. No, it's not, Lancelot, Rogue Knight said. He was found as the victim, with a sword in his hand covered in the victim's blood. The necromancer wouldn't be caught in such a stupid way, said Lacondas. No, he was caught, said Brandeis stubbornly. He shall die. I found him, with his sword in him. He was. Then he asked me to take it out of him. He was my friend. I couldn't say no to him, said the survivor. Likely story not, said Red Knight. You're a cop to the brain, Blackwood Knight snapped back. It's true, said the survivor. He looked Lakelandite in the eyes, saying, help me, Dad. I will, my boy, even if he kills me, said Lakelandite, glaring at Rodendite. I hope you're proud of yourself, Lance. You got your son in trouble, and if he's killed, it will be on your head, said Blake to his son. You judging me already, Dad? Said Lakelandite. I'm the judge of the dead. Judging people is my job, boy, said Blake. In the afterlife, he was a grim reaper. At the time, so was Lakelandite. Judge me all you want. I'm thinking, said Lakelandite. Who are you planning on killing now? Don't tell me. I'd rather not know, said Blake. I'm not planning on killing anyone, said Lakelandite. I'm thinking of saving my son's life. Fine, said Blake. Sending yourself in will help there. Yeah, right. You love that, said Lakelandite, tearing his head. You deserve to be locked up again, Blake snapped. I'm still tasting metal. It lingers on my lips. They just want me. But I never forget. Oh. Said Lakelandite, referring to a time he went to prison as a necromancer with the police. He was cleared, of course. You two finish fighting. We have to save Junior. Lakelandite's adult daughter, Christine said. Okay. She was visiting her grandfather and father's workplace. Blake looked like he was glaring at Lakelandite. Yes, said Blake. That's all I wanted, Lakelandite said. What should we do? Asked Christine. I don't know, said Lakelandite. Was it you who killed him? Asked Christine. No, said Lakelandite. Then who killed him? Asked Christine. I know, said Blake. I read the paperwork on the victim's death. Who was it? Lakelandite asked. Later, do you confess? Red Knight asked Jasper with a feeling for time. No, I didn't kill anyone, replied Jasper. Before he was to be executed, you'll pay for your crimes anyway, necromancer, said Red Knight. Do you want a blindfold? Before we disintegrate you? No, said Jasper, who was looking at his grey wife, who was watching in the crowd. Any last words, asked Rednut? Yes. Lucaite, I love you, Jasper said to his wife before he was going to be killed. Turn on the disintegrator, shouted Rednut. There was an electrical arcing sound. Ashes to ashes. Dust to dust. Said Red Knight grimly. There was a flash. What the? Red Knight muttered. Jasper was gone, and two reapers were standing there. Mortimer, what have you done with my nephew? Asked Red Knight. He's not dead. Mortimer. Blake. The reaper hissed. He was a murderer. Said Red Knight. It's the necromancer. No, said the necromancer. In reaper form, I am. What? Said Red Knight. I didn't kill the victim either. Your nephew happened upon the victim, as you said, necromancer told Red Knight. Then who killed him? Asked Red Knight, confused. I know, said Mortimer. Don't be melodramatic, tell us. Red Knight said. Mortimer looked around the room. Well? Red Knight asked. Mortimer disappeared and appeared again. Behind a nervous alien. From Beetlejuice 5. He did. He used a sword to frame the magicians. Local aliens, said Mortimer. Why? Demanded Red Knight. The Beetlejuicean sang like a canary. He was working for a consortium that didn't want the mining deal with Alpha Centauri to go ahead, so they paid him to kill the ambassador. Prince Jasper was cleared, so he was brought back to the convention and his wife. He held her. You are safe, my love, said Morkite to her husband. Yes, Morkite, I love you, said Jasper. They kissed.
Interesting. That was a surprise response to the prompt. I was not anticipating stories like that. They did use the line from the prompt in the dialogue. So that's one way to do it. It was so much dialogue that it kind of felt like it was meant to be a play, because it could be people talking back and forth, since it was mostly presented through the dialogue. So unexpected entry, and a little bit longer than I generally have for anything on the show, but interesting choices. Thoughts?
I'm sorry. Yeah. You know, the universe is vast, without end. And out of the universe is a conversation among aliens. And as the reader, as the listener, we find ourselves in the chaos of no context. So we have to assume that this thing that has been given us, a thing with no point, has no point because it wasn't meant to have one, but to simply exist for what it is. And I've always found that fascinating. And yes, it was a trifle long, but sometimes things are.
This is true. I like that perspective. That was the only entry for prompt 2. For prompt 3, it is, but I found beauty in this pain, gave me strength to break these invisible chains. And the response we got to that is by Luke Jr. And I have posted that. If you would read it for me, please.
I will. Rendezvous roundabout. Temptations, ironic innocence. Arcing bevels, chaotic determination. Chains breaking away. Deflation within every disturbed scar. Sudden sunlight emitting within the slit in their skin. Aggressive, bone-chilling diversity. Discussion of my personal adversity. Upon the withered tree, it versus me. AI, I'm barking against the tree. Pain-like vines grasping freedom. Tentacles, orbing arrangements, estrangements, salutations. Treehouse, seldom invitations offer me protection, rejection on the mounted reflection, centuries old. Beauty within the cracks, no more looking back. Behind me, reflected them between the glass, me, where I watch on the existence of another vessel. Plasmatic phantom of the silent opera, abrupt operation. Yet the smile is no longer fake. To the world, it now is flipped. A beauty's reality often dipped, lowering affirmations, abysmal drifts, droplets of realization. Flooding won't confirm. Walls for protection, they reaffirm nested veil. We're all on this shapeless, endless veil. End poem.
Great read and fascinating, right? I like the way it kind of talks about things in kind of, I was going to say oxymoron, but that's not quite right. It's opposing ideas that are working together, like erotic innocence, not necessarily mutually exclusive. But generally, innocence is seen as not, I was going to say corrupted by erotic, but that's definitely my Catholic upbringing. It's usually the two are not necessarily entwined, although I suppose innocence can be appealing in some ways, but I'm just going to stop there and answer that one and move on to the next one that was opposing ideas. Protection and rejection. Offer me protection, rejection. Protection and rejection are not often the same. They're not opposites exactly, but I see protection as like pulling them in and taking care of them, rejections pushing them away. So to be offered, to request to be offered both is interesting. Although I suppose sometimes rejection can be protection if, you know, they're thinking, I'm going to be bad for you. You move on to better things. Where is it now? There's another one that was like that. Silent opera is... when I think opera, I think of like it's not quite correct to say, but like the fat lady singing. I say as fat lady myself. the big bold, usually in a European language, like really blasting it out. So a silent opera is totally different. There's just a lot of back and forth kind of feeling, and that's interesting. It makes me want to consider each line. And then also chain-like vines grasping freedom. So chains generally take away freedom, but here they are trying to to capture it in a good way, like to let's give freedom through these chain-like vines. So there's so many ideas that kind of go around in a circle, which I really enjoy. Droplets of realization, flooding won't confirm. I also really enjoy that line. Some interesting thoughts here that I have to ponder with before actually fully grasping. What did you think?
I'm a little adrift when it comes to the meanings within this, that because each stanza seems to be addressing something related, yet different at the same time. Let me just go to that first line, temptations, ironic, erotic, innocence. The idea of innocence within a certain context can be very erotic. An experienced individual, an inexperienced individual, what are the attractions? I think the attractions there are obvious. He talks about chains breaking away, a deflation within every disturbed scar, sudden sunlight emitting within the slit in their skin. When you have a determination, despite it being chaotic determination, and you lose the chains, there can feel like there is a sudden deflation, because when chains break away, all of a sudden you're free, but then those chains were kind of holding you together as well. So you can feel deflated, and it wakes up all those old wounds. It disturbs the scars and maybe lets the sunlight of understanding in a little bit, as he says, emitting within the slit in their skin. Aggressive, bone-chilling diversity, discussion of my personal adversity, lines that coexist, rhymes. But not quite sure where he's taking it at that point. It's it versus me, AI. I'm not grasping in totality what he's trying to do there. Maybe you can help me on that in a moment. I like this from the point of view of the language usage and the ideas within. I would have to read it at least two or three times to put together any kind of a cohesive overall comment that satisfied anyone.
Yeah, I also think need to fully, ponder it before I can answer the overall thing. Because it's me versus AI barking against a tree. I mean, AI being artificial intelligence, but I'm not totally sure within this context where he was going with that either. So I would be curious to hear him talk about it. Luke, you got to call in sometime. This is the thing. I have to, peer pressure people into, if you want us to understand, call.
Amen. Amen.
All right. The next one to the same prompt is by Blue Leader 1. Actually, is it to the same prompt? No, it's not to the same prompt. I apologize. Prompt 4. It's too late to save me. Yeah, don't you come my way. Don't you pray for me, because I save myself. I've already saved myself, is the prompt. And now, this is Life in a Flash by Blue Leader 1. A jet falling at speed, swift oblivion and death. In the last moments of my life, I hold everything I love in my arms. I say over and over, I love you, 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 to my immortal beloved. Everything I want is in my arms. Everything I need is in my arms. It's freedom in my arms. The Lord is in my arms. My heart never did beat stronger. My mind never did think clearer. My soul was never cleaner. My breath is deep and steady. looking out a window. The sun is as bright as an atom bomb. I have no doubts. The shadows fall away. It's enough that I believe. It's a relief. All the ties that held me down are now loose. It's time for me to say goodbye. It's time for me to fly. End poem.
Oh, damn. That was an emotional read. I like the way you did that there. Life in a flash. The first lines, a jet falling at speed, swift oblivion and death, I'm going to assume are addresses the manner in which John Denver died. And it's almost as if this poem was written from his perspective, but I don't assume it is. It's written from the perspective of someone who loved John Denver. And in the same manner that he died, she also is dying, perhaps not in the same way. It's her time. And everything that I want is in my arms. Everything I need is in my arms. The Lord is in my arms. You know, end of life can be confusing, but it can also bring about a clarity, an understanding. My heart never did beat stronger. My mind never did think clearer. My soul was never clearer. I have no doubts. The shadows fall away. It's enough that I believe. And at this point, I think she's believing in an afterlife, in a heaven or in a hell. It's time for me to say goodbye. It's time for me to fly. You know, the spirit is about to leave its corporeal home and be turned, let loose. What a poem. It's very emotionally strong. I liked it. How did you like it?
I did too. And it kind of seems like almost like a suicide, but like a happy one in a way. It's like it's just probably just me being totally crazy, but when it's talking about having the love in my arms, I'm picturing they're either like, for some reason I'm picturing an urn. They're holding like the ashes of the person they love, who is perhaps, I forget, John Denver, I guess, just like wanting to be with him in the afterlife and looking towards joining him. So seeing this as a positive thing, falling with love and going towards it, feeling like exhilarated and determined. Really interesting that my soul was never cleaner. To be at the end of your life and feeling like all of that is like everything bad has been cleansed, and especially in terms of like choosing to end your life, because this feels like jumping out of a plane and trying to be with the lost love. But I mean, I don't know, that's just where my mind went, but I'm strange, so who knows?
Fabiana?
Yes?
I know you know who Ren is. Have you heard his latest piece called Suicide?
No, I don't think that I have. I'm going to have to. I love Ren.
You really should. You really should. It's not that long, but it is really unique. And it may not be what you think. It is, yeah, it's what you think, but it isn't what you think at the same time. It's a must listen to.
I definitely will, like probably right after the show.
He's unbelievable. That guy. Wow.
I agree. Brilliant. Very intelligent man and so talented. I love listening to Ren.
You know, I got to admit this. There isn't a day that goes by that I don't sit and listen to at least, and I'm serious, 2 hours of his songs. Every day.
Wow. I mean, like, that's more dedicated than I am, but I can see why. I was on a little road trip this past weekend with my husband, and we had downloaded, or he had downloaded, Ren's album, and we listened to it, and it just, there's so much there that's, like, it's absolutely brilliant lyrics. Okay. Where was I? Oh, yeah. So.
You were about to present the next poem.
I was. So, still to prompt 4, which is, it's too late to save me. Yeah. Don't you come my way. Don't you pray for me, because I saved myself. I've already saved myself. And the next one for that is Truth by Opti. It's brevity. And I believe it's your turn to read.
All righty. Truth. Being free was always down to me. Lost my way, blamed it on the others. I know I gave it all away. It was my fault. What can I say? I was immersed. I was that. I was like you. I never saw the truth. Blind and imprisoned in the lie we live, left with nothing. Nothing to give. End poem.
Excellent read. This is interesting. I like that there's the exclamation mark in the title, because that it just... It changes the contest, the context that I read it in. Like, truth can be so matter of fact, but this is like truth. Like, it's, I don't know, and I'm not entirely sure how to take it, but I think that exclamation mark is important here. And there's that idea of having never seen the truth. Didn't have any truth to give, because it didn't have the truth, and you can only give what you have. You can only pour from you can't pour from an empty cup. So there's this idea that, like, if you're never provided with freedom and truth, how can you reasonably give it? And then there is a kind of sense of responsibility where admitting that blamed things on others when it was them who the poet who, or the character who, the narrator, who had lost their way. And I like the repetition of nothing. Really emphasizes it. Interesting, though, because it's still, to me, it sounds like someone who does still need to be saved. But the prompt is, like, I've already saved myself. You don't need to worry about me. But this feels like the person is still really struggling. What did you think?
Yeah, there's always struggles. I'm not going to try and paraphrase what you said about it, because what you said about it was the essential. It was, I can't improve on it, in other words, but I have to absolutely agree with those last lines. We live left with nothing, nothing to give. As I think you said, if you have nothing, there's nothing for you to give. If everything is false, and then just runs like sand through your hands when you try to pick it up, you can't give that to anyone. And that the truth itself, which unfortunately these days suffers quite a bit, everything seems to assail truth with alternate truths, facts with alternate facts. And we're left with nothing with that kind of thing. And this has some references in my mind to the society of today, and what we're dealing with on a regular basis from people who try to alter truth. Now, this is written on a personal note, but I think it also applies in a larger sense. And great peace.
I like when things do that. Like, there's, like, that microcosm where it's, like, the small thing is actually representative of the big thing as well. So it can, your personal experience being written about can show societal stuff at the same time. Actually, Daniel Dischino is really good at doing that, too. He tends to, like, start off small and then expand it out. So
that's
very
right.
Well, Opti. I wish I did that more. I tend to just get focused on, like, one little feeling, and I don't so much look at the big picture in my writing.
Yeah, well, story within a story within a story.
This next one was to multiple prompts. He wrote it in the end. Let's see. So he said, section one is prompt one. Section two is another failure on my part. Section three is prompt two. Section four is a translation of a Dutch poem I wrote. Section five is related to a song. And section six is based on prompt four. So
Ben, that is nothing if not ambitious.
Right? And yet, you know what? I bet it's going to be successful because Ben tends to write, like, absolute masterpieces. He's one of my regulars
in
my podcast.
Oh, yeah.
Let's see how it goes. When It Mattered by Ben Hart. One, open. Today, I didn't win. And whoever said that after the storm, the cool would come back, was a fool or a hack. A poor betting man, then Jack, or worse, an optimist. When I just spent the day resisting, they'll tell me I should have listened to those who said they had missed me. So, and I wouldn't have felt it then, the weight lifting, the horizon no longer something I'm kept in, but somewhere to go. Two, happy 23. I forgot your birthday, and you said it was okay. In a sweet-hearted attempt to ease me, but I'd rather you just scream. You don't have to make it up to me. You just had to make it. Where were you, Ben? And why is it so hard for you to be a good friend? I thought you said you were trying again. Guess you lied. Where is the one I met then? Because all you'll tell me is that he died. The one you used to hate, who you now look up to, waiting where you leapt with haste when everyone was trying so hard to stop you. It's too late to change. Maybe it's for the best. You didn't show because I thought you were worth the wait. But now I know. Now I know. The one day I didn't think of you, poorly I chose. I'm sorry, dear. I can see why you chose something close over something so scattered because at least they were here when it mattered. 24 hours. Insomnia. Get paid in praise. Don't wait. Don't be late. For amnesia to fade. Don't negotiate with teenage terrorists. What a mess we made of democracy. Everything I see fucks with sleep, and everything I worship is falling out of love with me. I thought youth was coming back. Perhaps it was always so bleak. Four. It's over. It's done. The stare. And if I leave now, how will tomorrow know to meet me there? The pointless reach we call time that has nothing to tell or teach. The heaven called earth, plagued by the gravity they all say is just weight. Every desperate heaving at a life out of reach. And everything, including the day you saw me smile, was all a dream. No reprieve. So far in my 20s, no reprieve. Still, please don't leave. Five. Last round. No chance. Love. I believed it. And she's made of rose and smoke, of old friends and burnt romance. And I'm just a ghost, made of sticks and stones, who doesn't stand a chance of ever being close to you again. Because even if I try, even if I fight, you'll still just be alone. I'm so sorry that you regard intended, and I was overgrowth, that I was choke trying to keep you from leaving, that you were real, and I was just dreaming. Sorry, love, that I believed I could even handle half of happiness, because I am just a pugilist blue, never the champion. 6. The champion? Maybe, just maybe, by the skin of my teeth, I just might save the world. But don't weep, there's no saving me. And poem.
Great read there, dear. I enjoyed that a lot. Ben, like I said before, he's an ambitious poet. And he almost always succeeds in what he tries to do. Initially, the reads can be a little involved, especially on a cold read. You need to go back and study, because it's really worth studying. But here we have a rather long piece that seems to be about where was he during times when it really mattered. Now, when he says, today I didn't win, and whoever said that after the storm, the cool would come back, is a fool or a hack. You know, when you say, after the storm, I'm assuming a blow-up, a fight between two people, perhaps. And, you know, are things going to return to the way they were? And no, they don't. And, you know, you can resist that all you want to, but it doesn't necessarily come back. And by example, forgetting the birthday, and you said it was okay and a sweethearted attempt to ease me, but rather you just screamed. He wants to see the anger, the frustration, because this is probably is not the first time that this has happened. He wants to be asked, where were you, Ben? And why is it so hard for you to be a good friend? Again, referring back to the title about things mattering. He wants to be asked, or at least so you were trying again. Guess you lied. Where is the one I met then? Because all you'll tell me is that he died. The person that you fell in love with, the person that you chose to establish a relationship with, is that person is no gone. Is now gone. That one day I didn't think of you poorly, I chose. I'm sorry, dear. I can see why you chose something close over something so scattered, because at least they were here, that it mattered in the way that he hadn't. And this does not necessarily make life a great thing for them. Lack of sleep flows into insomnia. Talks about teenage terrorists, what a mess we made of democracy. Again, a poem that has wider views of the world and perhaps personal things that are in this. And it, part of this affects him, because everything I see, it fucks with sleep. And everything I worship is falling out of love with me. The world is, he used to love the world and he thought the world loved him. Now everything that he worshiped is perhaps somehow estranged. And part of that, I think, is because of age. As you approach the end of this magnum opus, and he says, it's over, it's done, it's there. And if I leave now, how will tomorrow know to meet me there? It begins to sound a little bit serious when he says every desperate heaving had a life out of reach, and everything, including the day you saw me smile, was all a dream. Everything that happened in the past, everything that he managed to achieve, the way that he was viewed, all a dream without reprieve. I'm going to stop at that point because I'm going to let you finish off the end and correct me on my initial observations. I'll simply say that this is one hell of a poem.
I don't think there's anything to correct. I liked your comments. The part that you mentioned where it said something about, like, I can see why you chose something close instead of so scattered. I definitely feel that. And it's like sometimes you might be the the better match in some ways, but you're not reliable. I've definitely experienced that. I've been on both sides of that. You know, sometimes you have to choose the closer, more responsible choice than the very scattered, troubled but lovable one. I really liked when it talked about and if I leave now, how will tomorrow know to meet me there? I like that it personifies tomorrow there. It's like, how will the future know where I am? And that reminds me a lot of a poem I really like called The Future by Neil Hilborn. And it's sort of like trying to figure out, like, if he's going to be in the future, if he should be in the future, because he's kind of suicidal. And at the end, he's like, I can see the future, and I'm there. And he just decides that he's going to be a piece of it. And this kind of has that kind of questioning. It's like, how will tomorrow know to meet me there? I found that stanza very interesting. Gravity is something that I think is well put in a place where it's talking about emotions that weigh you down. Gravity is one of those things that you don't notice until you really notice it, until you feel like pulled down, and just like everything takes extra effort. Gravity just feels appropriate when talking about the kind of struggle to be who he wants to be, to be there when people need him. I just think about like when you're really depressed and you kind of like lose yourself in like never getting out of bed, and then when you finally snap out of it and it's like you missed important things, you weren't there when it mattered to people, and gravity was just holding you down. That's kind of how I connected that part. This part kills me a little bit because it makes me feel so old, because he's like, no reprieve so far in my 20s. I happen to know that Ben is 23. So far into his 20s, the 3 years into his 20s, he hasn't felt like he's accomplished much. Ben, you have so much time. You are going to do so many great things. Like, you're already very accomplished for a 23-year-old. Give yourself a break. So far into your 20s, you will find reprieve.
It's almost intimidating.
Right? Yeah, like, there's, like, so much ahead of him that can be intimidating. But it's, yeah, there's still so many possibilities. I feel so old today because I was talking to a bunch of kids who I work with. Well, kids. See, this is also me being old. They're 18. But, like, a bunch of the teens who I talk to all the time at the library just graduated high school yesterday. So they're all talking to me about how they're moving away and stuff. And they're like, hi, okay, so I'm turning 17 or I'm turning 18. I was just like, I don't know. They still look like little kids to me. So I'm like, how old am I that you still look like when you're too young to be graduating?
Oh, yeah. Point of view.
Point of view. I am having that moment because I was like, no, you must be like just going to high school. And they're like, going to university. I'm like, no, it's not allowed. I'm still in university. No, I'm not, but I feel like it. Okay, I'm getting off track today.
When you view young people like that, I feel such a sense of envy. They think they know what's coming, but they have no idea. And yet I envy that because the world is their oyster. Use an old phrase. The possibilities are endless, and all they've got to do is grasp the thread.
Mm-hmm. I do miss that optimism. I remember when I first left, like, university, which I was in for 6 years because I just didn't want to leave. And when you leave that kind of like academic bubble of like all those people who are still like planning their lives and like have so many ideas and just like there's an optimism there. And then you go out into the real world and people are like worn out and more pessimistic, and it's so different. And I was like, I want to go back in my bubble. mind you, that was many, many years ago. I have to say for Ben that this is a little bit harder for me to read than most, just spacing wise. I don't know. I'm like, he changes his spacing depending on different factors. And I liked the way it was in part four. I just found it easier to read when the space was just between the stanzas. There's so much spacing in the other parts that, I don't know, I found my eyes were not adjusting right. But I like that he varies it because when it gets to the next section in six, it's all tight together, and it's like that changes the pace of it. The spacing is intentional, and I do appreciate that. I just found it a little bit harder to read this time. But I do like that he switches it up. So I don't know what I'm saying, because at first I'm like, Ben, make it easier to read. And then I'm also like, Ben, I love how you make it difficult. It tells me to read it differently, at least in my mind, because I cold read it, I didn't really feel prepared to switch it up verbally. But I do like when there's a kind of an indication of change of tone or perspective, because he often shows different perspectives.
Yeah, he moves the dynamics around.
He does. I am a fan of Ben, that will continue. And now it's your turn to read your poem. As I go down the board, I find you there. So here we go. You're up when you're ready.
Yeah, this is one of those poems that really needs work, but it's being presented nonetheless. It's called My Blood. Elements of pain and hope. Opposing emotions lay twisted into a knot that refuses unraveling. Tangles of despair, woven into briars of pain and anger, lay in the same bed as hope, whose down, feather soft, cradled sleep, proving impervious to such thorns, but nothing blunts the beauty of their blades, curved tips scoring the metaphysical. Strange bedfellows, these emotions, holding an uneasy truce which splits a middle ground. Pain is a given, wearing a thousand different faces, each a mask formed from the rag and bone of me. No matter the care taken to dig out the roots of pain, they are ubiquitous, like invisible chains, and wrapped in silk and barbed wire, pleasure, affliction, and hope never dies, never yields to the pain, both drinking from the same cup of my blood. End poem.
Wonderful read and poem. I really like the way that you paired things in this. The anger in the same bed as hope. And especially how you made it, the tangles of despair woven into the briars of pain. It's like I'm picturing like the hair wrapped around the thorny, I guess, briars. another word for it, but yeah. And how each of those represents the different feelings all stuck into that bed. And the idea of like something so soft and gentle as the feather down being not harmed by thorns that you would think are because they're so sharp and strong that would be a disrupting thing, but sometimes being so soft allows you to kind of wrap around things and not be fragile, which
right.
works out nicely. So that works that works really well metaphorically too, because sometimes if you're emotionally flexible, if you're a person who can kind of like work things out and be more gentle during difficult times, you're less likely to get hurt by the thorns. I mean, I see that myself, like at work. I work with a lot of, we call them unhoused, but basically people who are struggling with homelessness. There are a few who, you know, get defensive naturally if people kind of tell them to move along or to do something different. But there's one guy who tends to fall asleep, and usually the security guards kind of like yell at him, and then he causes a scene. But if I go over and I'm just like, "Hey, Eric, you look like you're feeling a little groggy today. Why don't you go for a walk and you come back?" And like, I'm just like, you know, if I'm soft about it, he doesn't fight. The thorn does not hurt me.
Yeah,
so it depends on how you do it. The beauty of their blades. I also like that, both metaphorically and because I'm kind of a nerd for swords and daggers. So as soon as I hear blades, I'm just picturing pretty things. you had me at blades. The idea of all the emotions going together and having this truce where they have to work together is a really great way of seeing like the whole picture of being a person, because you aren't just the good feelings or just the bad feelings. You need to have a mix of things. And I liked Pain is a Given wearing 1,000 different faces, each a mask formed with the rag and bone of me. We had this therapist come and talk to us at work this week because there was a big tragedy last week. And one of the things that he talked about was how each emotion has a lot of feelings within it. So he was like, grief has all of these different feelings, and those are all part of grief. And anger has a whole bunch of different feelings that go within that. And then all of those faces, all those masks come out differently. So like, even if we were all dealing with grief, we all had different ways of feeling it and of showing it. So those were the different masks. So that's just what came to mind when I read that. I was like, this really matches what that therapist guy was saying, counselor, whoever he was, trauma dude. That part really, really hit me. I even if that's not how you meant it, it worked with my current situation. Sometimes you twist poem, you project yourself into a poem, so I'm bad for doing that. And then you have such just wonderful language, like ubiquitous, just wonderful vocabulary, just makes everything like elevated. Hope never dies, never yields to the pain, both drinking from the same cup. And they are all connected. I like that both silk and barbed wire are used. You are a mix of things, and that's both beautiful and challenging to have all sides of things. Well done.
Thank you so much. Great comment there. I feel much better about the poem now.
It's awesome. Yeah, for real. I only speak the truth. I'm actually really terrible for that, where I like am incapable of lying if I don't like something.
Okay, I got you.
I have no filter. Or sometimes
you know
I can
what? I appreciate that. I appreciate that because sometimes content is heavily filtered. You know what I mean? So. That's great.
Mm-hmm. We do have a little bit of time left. I put one of my old ones up just
yeah,
in
I'm
case.
I'm looking forward to it. Yeah.
Well, you know, I honestly don't really remember how this goes. I was searching for keywords of my own things. Like, this kind of works. So let's see what it is. It was the last one. I confess. Okay. Chains and Currents by Faisiana. I tie myself to people in hopes of finding a stillness, not trusting life's winds that send me off course. When blue lightning flashes through my veins, igniting every nerve with unearthed, untethered energy, I can feel my warring auras burning me inside out. The only hope is to find a grounding presence. The ambitious yacht lends me an anchor. It is fashioned in gold with beautiful etching. I am still, but not in the way I craved. The chains tighten in condescension, branding me with their logo, demanding a dazzling display of gratitude, for he reached so far below him to help. Somehow I drift. The pirate, Karak, offers a cannonball. I mistake this attack as a kindness, excited by the dark sails hinting danger, willingly walking the plank, tied to wait, grateful for a flicker of scoundrel's attention. Somehow, I drift. An emerald piece wrapped waves me over. He remarks on my windswept natural beauty. He crafts with his bare hands a driftwood anchor, donating his long blonde hair, braiding it into rope. His intentions are pure, but he hasn't the strength to hold me in place when the waves crash. Somehow, I drift. As I float, stained in salt water, lips parched, on the edge of drowning, I know there must be a steady steel somewhere to capture the space between abyss and atmosphere. End poem.
Ah, bravo, Faisiana. I knew I was going to like this, and I do. You employed some great metaphors in this. I tie myself to people in hopes of finding a stillness, not trusting life's winds that send me off course. I guess individuals can be absolutely untethered from their moorings, if I may, by life's vicissitudes, the downs and the ups that can come in such quick succession. Those things that you call life's winds that can blow you off course, and you need to find that person or that thing that can anchor you and keep you steady, keep your resolve. And you kind of talk about that when you say blue lightning flashes through my veins, igniting every nerve with untethered energy. You can be filled with such energy that isn't controlled, though. It's like a fire that is blazing out of control. And you say, I can feel my warring auras burning me inside out. The only hope is to find a grounding presence. And the next stanza offers that grounding presence. He uses the metaphor of an ambitious yacht, lends me an anchor. It's fashioned in gold with beautiful etching. And it does keep you still. It does calm you down, but not in the way that you need. The anchor that this individual is offering comes with chains, condescending chains, if you will. And you become what he represents. And I think all of a sudden you're obligated because it demands a dazzling display of gratitude, for he reached far below him to help, as if he was reaching below his station and elevating you, who didn't really belong there, but he's going to bring you up. And in return for that, he wants gratitude. And then you use that wonderful line that you use several times in the poem, somehow I drift. And now we're moving to someone else. You call him the pirate Karak. I'm not sure of the name, The offer is a cannonball. So the offer is there, but what is the offering? Cannonballs are rarely representative of an act of kindness. And you say, I mistake this attack as a kindness. You know, we have the dark, dangerous lover, if you will, or individual. And it can be exciting. Excited by the dark sails, hinting danger. Willingly walk the plank, tied to wait. Grateful for a flicker of scoundrel intention. This individual is also someone that you seek grounding from, but it's a different kind of weight that he is offering. And again, you drift, moving on to someone else. And this is a beautiful stanza. An emerald peace raft waves me over. He remarks on my windswept natural beauty. Here we have a flatterer. But, you know, his intentions are pure. But he hasn't the strength to hold me in place. He is alluring, but it is far too light to ground you in the way that you need grounding. He is an artist, a poet, a writer, a sculptor, whatever he is. He's like a lot of artists who are flighty unto themselves and untethered, but willing to be blown by the wind. Wherever it takes them, that's their modus operandi, that's their purpose. And then again, somehow I drift. As I float, stained in salt water, lips parched on the edge of drowning, I know there must be steady steel somewhere to capture the space between abyss and atmosphere. Now that's a wonderful ending. That steady steel that you seek or and may have found, I should add, that individual who is strong yet gentle, caring, nurturing, respectful, helpful, undemanding of gratitude, ready to help a port and a storm, if you will, capturing the space between abyss and atmosphere, from the depths of the ocean to the heights of the envelope of Earth. It's a very large space, and that's the space you inhabit, the large space. You need that steady steel. I enjoyed this thoroughly, my dear, and I don't know if I'd have made any mistakes in my conjectures and analysis, but I know we've got a couple of minutes. You can tell me where I went wrong.
No, you were all right. Really, that you understood, which is awesome because I can be a little – obscure sometimes. I think it was a little bit more direct in this one, but yes, you totally understood. Thank you. I really appreciate your comments and analysis. I had honestly forgotten about this poem, and then I was trying to dig up something that had to do with chains, and it worked out nice. It was a revival of something that I forgot about.
Is this one of those poems where you look at it and you go, did I write that? I can't remember writing that. Who wrote this?
Yes. I tend to almost have practically visions when I'm writing. It just kind of blurts out of me, and so it's unless it's for a contest where I'm specifically trying to craft something, most of my poems just kind of come out the way that they are. So I forget once they're out of my head. They get stuck in my head until I write it down, and then they're just gone.
Yeah. On more than one occasion, I've read one of my poems. It popped up somewhere, right? I'm reading it, mm-hmm. And I go, it feels vaguely familiar, but boy, it's pretty damn good. I wonder who wrote this. And I see it was shocked that it was me. It happens all the damn time. I don't hold poems. Once I write them, I seem to forget them. And then when I go back and read them, it's kind of really enjoyable. It's like as if I was another person at the time, and I'm reading the thoughts of then. But, you know, this is now. And it seems unfamiliar, but enjoyable.
Oh, I love that. See, but you're a very talented writer. If I go back and read mine, I usually find mistakes. I'm like, oh, this person messed that up.
How much do you edit? Are you a thorough editor or do you not edit?
It depends. Usually I'll read it a couple of times after I wrote it, and I'll fix, like, obvious mistakes, but the general gist of things, I usually leave it as it is, and I'll just kind of tweak little bits to make it flow better.
You shouldn't find too many flaws when you go back later on and look.
Oh, I sometimes do, though. I notice it on the shows, for sure. It's like, when you read it out loud, that's when you see your mistakes. Rhyme always tells me, whenever I'm writing something, he's like, read it out loud. I don't care if you're going to be presenting it out loud. Read it out loud. And he's absolutely right, because I find mistakes when I read it out loud. You can see when it gets choppy.
Hey, look, this is a great evening of poetry. I really enjoyed doing this.
Me too. Thank you so much for calling and being here and sharing your insights. It was really great having you here.
I'll chat with Jean if I might do another one.
That'd be wonderful. All right.
Okay.
This time next week, I'll be here. Of course, yes. We'd love that.
All right.
Tomorrow night is Double Helix with me and Dan for the earlier show. And we have a piano player who wrote some pieces, Katarina Supineski. And she's going to be calling in and giving her opinion on the poems inspired by her piano songs. Should be interesting to hear how she feels. Yes, I'm excited about it. Dan is so good at, like, befriending people who he meets online. He finds artists and instrument players and all different kinds of people, and he'll be like, hey, so I want to do a poetry contest. Can I use your stuff? They'll write something or draw something specifically for us, and then we'll do poems, and they'll comment on it. I'm just like, he's so brave about talking to people. I'm shy about approaching people, and he's just like, hey, I like your music. Come to our show.
people like that kind of brashness. Sometimes it really works.
It would seem so. Dan's good at it. So I'm grateful that he is, because I'm certainly not. And it'll be wonderful to have Katarina there. And her songs are beautiful, so I'm excited. We are out of time. Thank you so much for calling. Thank you to everyone who shared their poetry. And we'll see you again soon.
All right. Good night.